You're listening to Midwest Vegan Radio.
We're sharing all our secrets.
We're sharing all of our secrets just for you special listeners.
With your hosts, Dallas.
That sounds so good.
And Ryan.
Pass the noosh.
All right, we are here and it's episode 7.
A super special episode.
Yeah, it's a lucky episode.
Well, yeah.
We're really lucky because we have Will Potter here.
We do. We have a super special guest today. So welcome, Will.
Thanks, y'all, for having me.
Oh, wait. I'm Ryan.
I'm Dallas. You guys should know that by now.
Elliot's over there. Well, we still always announce this.
Okay.
Just in case people don't know who we are.
Noreen is over there.
Hanging out.
Okay. Now everybody knows who we are. Can we move on?
We can move on.
Okay, thanks. So, episode 7, we are going to be talking with Will Potter, who is, if you don't know already, Will is a journalist out of D.C., now. And he is, you'll have to help me with your credentials and stuff. I know you have a lot of them and they're all wonderful, but the main thing that people need to know is that Will is, the writer for a blog called Green is the New Red,
right,
and also now the author of the book by the same title.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to be talking about both of those things. And essentially it's, I guess the way I would describe it is kind of both a reporting and a personal account of government repression, of animal rights and environmental activists, and particularly around terrorism enhancement and legislation and, you know, the use of the word terror and how that's shown up in the rhetoric around the word terror in the last, I don't know, it's been a decade now.
Right.
A decade. That's so hard to believe. It's weird.
I have to say, I was actually terrified to read the book. And it's a fantastic, beautifully written book. But I was really scared to really find out about, you know, we had this, what was it? The egg gag bill that they were,
oh, yeah.
Is that what it was called? Which is scary that even came up. And so, you know, the timing with us getting the book in and reading it and doing it for our book group and with the bill that they were proposing, just, it's so scary to think about. Do you want to just kind of talk about?
I think first there's two things that aren't totally clear. The egg gag bill.
Yeah.
Let's explain that. So in Minnesota and also Iowa, Florida too, there were bills introduced, agriculture gag. I mean, egg gag, that's mm-hmm. kind of what that's short for. But essentially what it would have done is put extremely harsh penalties on anybody who takes images, like either photograph or video, pretty much.
And sound.
I think that there were different versions of the bill, but
exposing any animal cruelty at all.
Yeah. I mean, essentially if you're on property that is owned by somebody else or you're in somebody else's institution, without their consent, you could be in big trouble.
It's the other 30 thing, years in prison, felony.
I think for
years?
The second offense at okay. one point, that's how it was written. And also, the same goes for being in possession mm-hmm. of any of these images, which is completely nuts. I mean, it's very much like the Red Scare kind of
mm-hmm.
Thing that we're going to be talking about. But the idea that, you know, you could be breaking the law if you had a Why Vegan in your car.
Right.
I mean, that's just bizarre.
And the problem with that, too, is that there are already laws on the books to, you know, to punish people for trespassing and things like that anyway.
Yeah.
So
this is an enhancement kind of situation. I mean, so Will can talk about that because he's the expert.
We'll eventually shut up and let him
talk.
We
will. But so there's that. And then the other thing too is the book group, which I wanted to mention. Ryan and I are both part of a book group through the Animal Rights Coalition. And we essentially, you know, we get to read about books related to animal rights, nutrition, environmentalism, all of that kind of stuff. And it might be fun to like mention what we're reading as mm-hmm. well. That might be a cool thing. So anyway, we read Green is the New Red.
Yes.
And I think it was, I can say for sure it was the best book group discussion that we've had so far. Usually we don't stay on topic.
That's very true.
Well, which is, you know, that's how book groups work. And obviously with us, yeah. in the book group, that doesn't work out so well. But really, there was so much to talk about with this particular, you know, people's personal feelings around it and fears around it, ideas of, you know, what do you do about this? There was just, it's a lot.
Have you thought about either on your website or in another edition of the book printing possible book group questions?
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
It certainly is something I've thought about. It's great to hear that there was interest and a lot of discussion. I've heard that from other folks too. I'd be happy to volunteer to put something like that up.
I think that would be a good idea.
We love being in a book group. I can say we love discussion questions, just a, you know, a starting point.
Right.
And I think that this is, you could probably easily come up with 20.
That's a great idea.
You know, and it would, yeah, it may encourage people to take it up, especially like not already animal rights or environmentally leaning book groups. But
and it gives people, even if they're not part of a book group, ideas to think about after the fact. And yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
We have questions.
Well, do you want to just talk about the book for people that don't know what it's about? Kind of.
Well, I think what I would like to know first is what are all your cool credentials that you have, like your resume. And I know usually, you know, somebody else would introduce you and you wouldn't have to brag, but I know there's things about Texas and there's things about awards.
Well,
and
depending on the audience, I don't know if Texas is something to bring up when, you,
yeah. when you're bragging. Yeah, I know. But, yeah, my name is Dallas and I get a lot of questions about Texas. And my stock answer is I have never set foot in Texas, which is true. But yeah, I don't particularly want to be associated with the state, and I'm even named after a city there. So
nobody ever asked me questions about Texas.
Well, I have a lot of Texas pride, so I'll put that out there. I mean, my background, born and raised in Texas, and I, but more importantly, my background's in mainstream journalism. Worked at the Chicago Tribune for a bit, moved to DC to work at the Chronicle of Higher Education, covering Congress, Dallas Morning News, and worked for a little bit at the Texas Observer, which is actually with the first story I wrote about these issues, and that really helped start that path in a way. So that's a little bit about where I'm coming from on this. Over the years, and I talk about this in the book also, I also struggled with the idea of being a journalist versus an activist, because I also have a background of being involved in a lot of social movements as well. And so that was a definite tension. And if I guess the only other credentially type thing I would throw out there is when I testified before Congress against the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, that was another kind of turning point of the activist versus journalist tension over the years, for sure.
And also not a lot of people have done that. I mean, testified before Congress from our movement, especially.
Sure.
But yeah, that's I would say that's a distinguished.
Well, thank you, Dallas.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for what it's worth from me, I'm so highbrow. But okay, so now we know why we should
take
Will seriously, and while he why
I don't know
he's
if
more
that establishes why he should take
that's why he should is that's more qualified to talk about least. This than just us. So yeah, it's good.
I want to know at what point in your life did you get interested in animal rights and writing about them, and you know, and being involved in the legal issues around animal rights? What was your evolution into this?
Well, became involved and aware of animal rights issues long before I became aware of kind of this crackdown and what I wrote about in the book. And I found out about just these issues in general because I was involved in social justice campaigns against the economic sanctions in Iraq and World Trade Organization protests and things like that. And a friend of mine who I respected very much was like, yo, you know, why don't you care? Why aren't you vegetarian? This doesn't make any sense. And, you know, it kind of took me aback. And I read Diet for a New America and went vegetarian immediately. And then 6 months later went vegan. This is in the late 90s. So that really started an obsession in a lot of ways for me, because once I started seeing what was going on in these places, it hit me more viscerally in some ways than the other issues I was working on. And it definitely struck a nerve. And then, you know, as years went by, I became more aware of when I was at the Observer, wrote about a woman who was sentenced to no protesting as part of a civil disobedience campaign.
Oh, wow.
And the judge in Dallas compared it to prohibiting pedophiles from being near churches and schools. And that's why he justified keeping an animal rights activist away from a fur store. And so that obviously, you know, begged for quoting this guy and doing a story. But as part of that story, I learned about, well, this is part of a coordinated campaign. And this was in 2001. And so over the years, I kind of got bits and pieces here and there. And then and I don't mean to dump too much information out there at once for people listening to this, but the Shaq case, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit, are some really good friends of mine. And mm-hmm. when those group of activists were rounded up and hit with terrorism charges, that pulled me more into this story as well.
Yeah.
I think I was vegan for a long time, and I think that, and I was heavily involved in volunteering, but I think a lot of people that are even vegan don't know about these serious issues that are going on, because it's, you know, if you don't hear about it, if people aren't talking about it, then you don't know that there's this crazy legislation trying to prevent us, and, you know, all of these big organizations that have the money to kind of try to, what you talk about in the book, trying to, what is the group that I'm thinking of where they...
Oh, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
Yes. Yep. ALEC or what is it?
ALEC.
Yeah, yeah. That they, you know, that they suggest bills, or is that what they do?
Right. So the way a group like ALEC works is they get thousands of dollars of donations from corporations, and those donations entitle corporations to have a seat at the table for these conferences. And at the conferences, corporations also pay scholarships for members of state legislatures to travel across the country. And they go to skeet shooting sponsored by the National Rifle Association.
Of course.
And they go to, you know, Broadway shows paid by pharmaceutical companies. And they do all these kind of fun things. And meanwhile, when they're out having fun, the corporations are actually drafting model legislation. And then these state lawmakers take it back home and introduce it, and all their colleagues have no idea it was actually drafted by corporations.
Right.
And obviously in the context of the book, one of these is a model eco-terrorism bill.
Mm-hmm.
But also out here in the Midwest, I mean, everything going on in Wisconsin, that came out of ALEC also.
Mm-hmm.
They're involved in a lot of issues.
Yeah, that's so disgusting to me. It really, I think, makes people feel... Me specifically, makes me feel helpless. Like, you know, I don't have the money that National Cattlemen's has, and, you know, how am I supposed to?
Well, I think, I don't know. I mean, I get really incredibly depressed about all of this stuff too sometimes, which is, I think, why a lot of people don't. I mean, it's so complex that it's hard to understand to begin with. I mean, it takes a lot of energy and a lot of focus and determination to even understand what's going on.
And your book is extremely well written and explaining things for people that don't really have an understanding of how those work.
Yeah. For the average person.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that I always think about whenever this, you know, we're faced with this kind of thing is that, yeah, we don't have the money and we don't have the influence and the power and we don't have control over the prison system and we don't, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But the thing that we have that they don't have is the truth. And, you know, what's right, essentially. And they're terrified of those things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that we have the truth. That's why they don't want images out there. Because, you know, if the average person did see what was happening and had the opportunity to understand it like we do, they would make changes. And then all of these industries would be, you know, they'd be bankrupt, essentially, because nobody would support that. The other thing too that, I mean, Will just mentioned, he mentioned earlier is, you know, that you kind of started leaning into animal rights stuff a bit more because once you saw what was going on, you saw it a lot. And so just for our listeners out there, I know that we have some people who are relatively new to veganism or maybe new to animal rights. And there's a window in there that I think is a really difficult transition period for people when you suddenly see violence all over that you didn't see before,
mm-hmm.
That was just completely invisible to you. And then, you know, you'll see it on the freeway, or you'll see it, you know, at a work lunch or whatever. You'll just see what used to look like food or what used to look like fun now.
Or a billboard or just an advertisement now is death and torture.
Yeah.
It's and a lies. Perspective.
Yeah. And all of that. And so, it can be really, it can, you know, it can make people feel isolated and overwhelmed and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, but it also is an incredible motivator and fuel for people to essentially say, wow, this is a big, you know, this is pervasive. It's everywhere. And I want to do something to help with that. So I don't know, that I just thought that that might be useful for somebody out there. Okay. So, and the other thing too, is when you talk about, one of the things that I have a hard time, with is that when I try to talk to anybody about this, I'm always afraid that I'm going to sound like a crazy conspiracy theorist,
right.
You know?
Absolutely.
Which I don't know. I mean, I've figured out a way to kind of dumb it down and talk to, you know, about the basics about the agricultural industry and the pharmaceutical industry and, you know, so that it's very, very basic. But when you start delving into all of the details of this and like the ALEC committee and who's giving, you know, who's buying seats on what and who's talking to who, it's, you know, I'm just always afraid that I'm going to sound like I'm crazy. So I'm happy that I have this book that I can point people to.
And that was a big concern of mine. I mean, not just with the book, but with the website and speaking stuff I think it does sound that way to a lot of people, because if you're not paying attention to any of these issues and you hear that even one, that these groups are the number one domestic terrorism threat, according to the FBI. And then you go into groups like ALEC that nobody's ever heard of, and sound really nefarious and, you know, underhanded and all this. And mm-hmm. then you learn about these, you know, there's secretive political prisons and all this stuff. And all of a sudden it becomes quite a black helicopter mm-hmm. crowd. And that crowd, you know, you can see by traffic to the website, they really embrace a lot of this. But I always try to really emphasize to people that, contrary to be a conspiracy theory, these groups are very transparent about what they're trying to do. They're not trying to hide it. They're very open about it.
I was wondering about that. Like, how did you get some of this information? But
I mean, a lot of different ways. I mean, sometimes it was talking to former FBI agents. Sometimes it was Freedom of Information Act documents and Homeland Security documents, or talking to activists. And a lot of times the best material was straight out of the mouths of these groups. By far, in the congressional testimony and documents they submitted, or in some cases, people supplying me with login information for internal websites of these groups who could really see what was going on. And they're blunt about what they're trying mm-hmm. to do and why. There's no conspiracy. They're very out in the open about it.
So I think now would probably be a good time to ask some questions. So I'll start. We had asked our friends on Facebook to let us know if they had any questions for Will, and we did get some. First, Holly Hansmeyer from Minneapolis, Minnesota said, do you feel optimistic or pessimistic about future animal rights legislation in the current political climate?
Yes. And it really depends on the day. You know, as we were talking about earlier with these ag gag laws in Minnesota, Iowa, Florida, New York, they keep coming, and I think they will, even if all of them are defeated in this round, which seems like a good possibility. There'll be
except
more
Iowa passed, right?
Iowa's still up in the air.
Okay.
So it looks like there's a good, it could go either way, but people need to remember these bills are going to keep coming, because with all of these attempts, it's not necessarily about the bill at the time. It's about constantly moving the needle, about mm-hmm. slowly and incrementally advancing these legislative attempts to the point where even if they don't get exactly what they want out of some bill, they try to get something, to get a little bit of a toehold in there.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll keep pushing. And we can't underestimate that, because that's been the problem on the federal level with like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, is people ignored it for so long. These groups pushed for this law since the 80s, and they got various improvements to it. So in short, at the same time, though, there are many days where I do feel optimistic, or at least I do feel like things are changing. You can see people's the awareness about these issues is changing. We're getting, for instance, with these ag gag bills, I was talking to NPR's On the Media, which is one of the top radio programs in the country, and they were extremely sympathetic, and the entire country has been against these bills when mainstream outlets have talked about it. So I think we need to remember that. that the struggle is not only against these bills and against the people pushing them, but it's a struggle to make people aware of what's going on. And I really firmly believe, no matter how many dark days I have and how depressed I can feel immersing myself in these issues, that if people knew about this stuff, they would take action. And we're seeing that more and more.
I kind of feel like it reminds me a little bit of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle somewhat, because this also, it doesn't only affect people being able to see what happens to animals, but it also affects people as well, because you're not able to document, you know, there are laws that aren't enforced about, mm-hmm. you know, animal treatment, but it also prevents people from exposing worker issues as well. So it just, bad stuff all
and
around.
And health issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody can just get in and take any kind of
fair labor stuff, and
and also contamination and whatnot. So
absolutely.
Okay, great. So we've got another question over here, and this one came from multiple people, and it's, you know, if you're willing to answer it or not,
or answer in a way that you're comfortable
or
with.
Or answer in a way that you're comfortable with. But a lot of people wanted to know what your personal feeling is about arson as direct action, and whether or not it hurts the movement more than it helps.
You know, in all the work I've done, I've really tried to stay away from talking about specific tactics. In large part, not because I don't have passionate views about that, because I do, but because I think it, in the context of this work, it deflects from the fact that these attacks on the movement are much bigger than any specific tactic. There's a reason that groups like the Humane Society are being labeled terrorist organizations at the same time as groups like the Animal Liberation Front and Earth Liberation Front. It's because all of them, with their diversity of tactics, no matter how much people may disagree with each other, combined are an effective threat. You know, that being said, I think these discussions, of course, need to take place. And I hope people read the book and see that I didn't try to gloss over any difficult questions that these things have raised. I mean, I wanted to focus on Daniel McGowan because he was involved in arsons in the name of the Earth Liberation Front. And that represents the most extreme this movement has been. So when we're talking about tactics, those tactics against property are the most extreme this movement has been. Mm-hmm. In the grand scheme of things, if you look at any other social justice movement, they have not stopped at property. Mm-hmm. The civil rights movement, human rights movements around the world, independence movements. So, you know, I hope people, when they're reading the book, will see the picture I've painted of what's going on as an honest one, as all the, you know, warts and all of what's going on mm-hmm. in the movement, that nobody is without their faults. But at the same time, these attacks are about much bigger than any specific arson or property destruction or act of vandalism or things that at the end of the day pale in comparison to what much more extreme movements are doing that are not being labeled as terrorist threats.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, or even kind of fringy, like the Ku Klux Klan or, you know, the right wing kinds of things. I appreciated that part of the book where you were able to say, look, this, you know, the communications management unit, for example, mm-hmm. like this person is limited to 7 pages a month or whatever it is. Yet while this other guy is able to write 25,000 word essays that are published on the internet, that's just crazy hate filled, you know, insightful, nasty. So I think it's a good thing to look at as well. And for people who are interested, because so many of you asked this question, if you are curious to, you know, read another perspective about arson in the movement, you might want to check out Operation Bite Back. It's a book by Dean Coupiers.
Kuiper.
Okay. I don't know. It's French, maybe.
Actually, I don't know.
I don't know, but I don't know how to pronounce it. It's like Illinois.
Yeah. I like to add an S on the end there.
Yep. But I think we
need to say, though, we are not endorsing or suggesting that you don't do direct action in any way, such as liberating animals or arson or whatever. Well, we're not endorsing. We're not taking a side on it either way, regardless of how we personally feel.
The black helicopters are going to come for us now.
Midwest Vegan Radio is not I know. Putting out a position on this.
Are you ready for that, Elliot?
I'm ready.
Okay.
Our producer's going to jail.
Yep. Sorry.
We promised to write.
Yeah, but you probably won't be able to read them, or like only 6 words at a time.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I think it's an important point to raise, because part of that question was, does it do more harm than good?
Right.
And it's a convoluted question, because mm-hmm. how do we examine the harm and the good?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, in one sense, the arsons in the name of the Earth Liberation Front in the late 90s and we're raising awareness about issues that now are very mainstream. Everybody is talking about genetic engineering, climate change. Mm-hmm. Nobody was talking about those at the time. So it's hard to parse out what role that had. At the end of the day, the places that were sabotaged were rebuilt. You know, so there's some clear, you can't, it's very hard to distinguish like what was a concrete, tangible win and what was a concrete, tangible loss in that.
Yeah.
So I'll put that out there as maybe just points to consider for people. And also more broadly and perhaps more directly to the work I'm doing, though, is that I always try to remind people that the attacks on these movements didn't originate and are not occurring because of specific tactics. But, and this is a very big but, that doesn't mean some of the actions that have been taken didn't make it easier.
Yeah.
Didn't grease the wheel to allow some of this to take place.
Yeah.
And that second part is something a lot of times when people are talking about tactics, they want to ignore, because it's either, well, I'm pro ALF, I'm anti ALF, I'm pro arson, I'm anti arson. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, at the end of the day, I think we need to be a bit more sophisticated than that, because even despite what you view about a specific tactic in and of itself, it doesn't mean it's always the best approach. And we saw that, for instance, with the case of Jeff Lewis, when he was on trial for arson. There were arsons that took place and were dedicated to him. And he was sentenced to 22 years and 8 months in prison. In large part, the judge's decision was a retaliatory action against these crimes taking place in his name. I think that's something to talk about.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, next question. Kim Socha from Minnesota, this is kind of a long one, so bear with me, says, you conclude that the war on animal and environmental activists is being waged partially by corporate interests along with general threats to tradition. With this so clearly being the case, has there been support for the animal/environmental cause by anti-corporate/anti-globalism activists? How much crossover is there between these movements? If not, is the anti-corporate movement a potential site of solidarity that activists should pursue?
I think one point I've really tried to emphasize throughout my work is the commonalities between the animal rights and environmental movements and other social justice movements. So for instance, in Green is the New Red, I don't focus as much on specific animal rights campaigns or specific environmental issues as much as I do on the kind of sentiment that they embody and the issues and the industries that they're targeting. And what I've found, especially since the book has come out and doing interviews like this and media and speaking events, is that people who are not animal rights people or not environmentalists get that. They really do. And it's been inspiring me to see people who don't know a whole lot about these issues at all and are not sympathetic at all to these activists even, but there's this feeling in this country of that corporations have way too much power. And that's not a radical critique at all. People know it. People feel it every day. People understand it. They understand it when laws are drafted for corporations and not for them, when they are suffering in their day-to-day lives and bankers getting multi-billion-dollar bailouts. I think there is a lot of commonality, but it's a question of how do we advance that? And I think there's a lot of resistance from the so-called old left, you know, capital L left, whatever you want to call it, to animal rights and environmental issues. And that's slowly being whittled away as these issues become more mainstream and more embraced. But that's going to be an uphill battle. I mean, there are a lot of groups doing fantastic work around this, though. I mean, the Rosenberg Fund for Children, which is a group that I started, actually just joined their advisory board, and they're a fantastic group founded by the son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were executed during the Red Scare. And they're on board with everything going on now, targeting environmental and animal rights activists because of these common threads. And I think it's something that, talking to animal rights activists, because I think there are a lot of them listening to this program, we need to be willing to step outside of bubbles and outside of comfort zones, and also to not underestimate people's capacity to understand where this is coming from. Because, yeah, they may not be vegan, and you may be tempted to get into an argument with them about that or about what they're driving or what they're wearing. But the awareness and the anger against the increase of corporate power in this country is really palatable.
Definitely.
I think in my own personal, narrative of being an animal rights activist vegan, it hasn't been until the last couple of years that I've started to really appreciate how much crossover there is in these different movements. And so that's one of the reasons that we have a green challenge in every episode of this, is because, you know, there is really no point to saving animals if there's no world for them to continue to live on and all of that. So, you know, just on a very, very basic fundamental level, the whole idea that, you know, people, you know, the golden rule, treat people as you would want to be treated, or that everybody is deserving of equal consideration at the very least, is, I think that we do share a lot more with other people than we tend to realize, or at least I did for a really long time. And I also feel like it's very easy with all of the, you know, you wake up and you see all of the violence everywhere that you didn't see before. It's easy to feel like, okay, well, there's so much trouble over here. There's so much pain and so much work that needs to be done. And there's not very many people doing it. Whereas over there, there's a lot more people who are sympathetic to helping other people. So I'm going to just focus all of my energy over here, and I don't have time to deal with all that other stuff, or I don't have the emotional capacity to take on any more. You know, I can't know about anything more that's going to hurt, but it's important that we kind of look for those threads. And
I was just going to say, one thing that's been amazing to me is in doing this work and working with a variety of groups, kind of trying to educate them and work on different court cases and lots of different things like that, I've gotten a lot of emails from people that have said, oh, you know, I've gone vegetarian, I've gone vegan. I've never talked to people. Like, in the context of this work, I don't come in and say, hey, let me tell you about this, you know, eco-terrorism crackdown and why you should go vegan. No, you know, nothing like that has ever happened. Yeah. But seeing that whatever some degree of commonality prompts people quite frequently to start examining the issues independently on their own, or to find out, well, why is it these animal rights activists are so passionate? Why is it people are going to these extreme lengths? And so another point for activists to consider, by approaching, meeting people where they are, it doesn't mean you're not exposing them to these issues. It's just in a different way.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool that people are able to kind of realize what's going on with these corporations and making the decision to go vegan without even having kind of a concern for animal background and just not even wanting to participate in those industries. It has nothing necessarily to do with animals, but not wanting to be part of those industries. That's awesome.
Well, and I don't mean to, you know, this sounds really cliche, but like the old, an enemy of my enemy is my friend. I mean, I think people, whether we think of it that way or not, it's kind of true. Like, you see, these aren't very savory players that are cracking down on these groups. And when you see this happening, it's kind of like, well, you know, maybe I should look into what these activists care about.
Okay. Well, I have got a question over here. It's from an anonymous person. And the question is, it seems that there's an undercurrent of, quote, advice throughout the book. Was this intentional? And I guess they mean, the notation is, don't talk, rules in prison, et cetera. So I don't really, I'm hoping you can pull something out of that.
So I think that, well, I would assume where the question was coming from was about sections where I'm talking about, for instance, when I was visited by the FBI, and I talk about how people should know their rights and how I knew I shouldn't talk to any law enforcement without an attorney. I don't have to say anything. And I tried to include bits like that throughout, not necessarily as kind of like a sneaky code or anything, but just it's part of the story. Mm-hmm. I mean, that whether it's instructional or not, I do hope people walk away from this learning concrete things in addition to theoretical things, mm-hmm. concrete things about groups like ALEC, like we were talking about, and also know your rights information, perhaps a little bit about what the legal system really is, what it's like to be indicted, or what it's like to have a grand jury and things like that.
Yeah, I think it would be easy to read something as advice when really what I read is these are the facts. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if you have an ounce of common sense, you're going to, you know, take those facts and think, oh, maybe I should behave in this way, mm-hmm. so as to protect myself as much as possible. So yeah, that I can see where that was too.
Yeah.
I should probably go to one of those Know Your Rights workshops or something. I don't know what it is that I avoid. I think I might have some sympathy to people who don't want to know about animal issues because they won't be able to handle it or something. But I mean, the FBI has been to my house, and my husband has, you know, like we've had the FBI, and my husband has been charged with a felony for animal rights stuff. And, you know, I mean, it's pretty personal to me. I have a friend in prison and, you know, various things, but I don't know. I feel like I've barely made it out so many times. So I should probably do that. But it's a good idea for just anybody mm-hmm. to know kind of what would happen. It's like a self-defense course.
Yeah. That which is funny though, because when we took it, I was almost like more afraid that I was going to be attacked by somebody now that have some skills to defend yeah. myself.
Yeah. It's like the more you know, the more you know you don't know.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. The more you know, the more you know you don't know enough.
Or
try
whatever.
To figure that out, guys. I dare you. That. I dare you.
That was a secret code for all of you listening.
Yeah, really. But I mean, I think, again, just having, if you have been through, you know, you've learned or heard it once or done it once, then the chances of you being able to actually do it in a real life situation are higher.
So. And that's exactly it. And, you know, in general, in a lot of ways, that kind of a fear was really a main character in the book. I mean, fear surfaced all the time. Fear surfaced with me. It surfaced with the other people in the book. Fear surfaced as a tactic the government used in the Red Scare in contemporary setting. But I think you really hit on it, which is, I think the first time you hear about anything like this, the fear is so much more powerful. And for me, when I went to we're talking about Know Your Rights trainings, I've been to those. And I remember the first couple I went to, I was like, this is making me more afraid because mm-hmm. it's talking all this nefarious, like FBI visits and all this stuff. I think you just have to break through that bit of a shell, though, because I think the more you learn about it, I firmly believe it can be empowering.
Mm-hmm.
And the Know Your Rights trainings can be empowering, and, you know, the self-defense yeah. trainings or whatever, because you got to remember that you can actually think about this and use it. And it's less about the novelty or the fear or the speculating what could happen, and more about the actual tools. And in some ways, I hope that's the case with the book.
Yeah.
I hope people come out of it. Maybe if this is the first time you've ever heard about this, it can be scary, but I hope and I think people need to walk away from this feeling like they came out of it with tools.
Yeah.
I mean, ways of viewing the world more critically to understand what's going on. And when we understand what's going on, we can fight back. And until then, we're afraid. And not only we're afraid, but we're ineffective.
Yeah. Well, I think about it in terms of like the government and the corporations being bullies, and, you know, they'll pick on you, but if you turn around and stand up for yourself, the chances that they'll continue are less. And maybe I'm making that up just to make myself feel better. But, you know, if you know
right.
what your rights are and you say, no, I'm not talking to you, go away, you know, and that's a legal thing to do. They're not going to tell you that.
Right.
I mean, so.
But that's, isn't that in the Miranda rights? I mean.
It's not the same with, you're not being arrested when they come to just talk to you.
But they do say that, though, that you have the right to remain silent. You have the right to.
No, that's when you're being charged or when you're arrested. It's not when they come and they just want to talk to you.
But yeah, you. But isn't that still your right? You do have the right to not say anything.
Oh, you do, but they won't tell you that.
Right.
Yes.
One of the things that was kind of a fear spot for me that kind of maybe wasn't the point. I certainly don't think it was the point in you talking about all of these scary things, though, was kind of fear of trusting people. Like I certainly felt a lot of fear and anger about the people that, you know, decided to wear wire and that named names, and kind of made me just really, really angry and kind of afraid of, you know, and I know that Dallas, we've had conversations about this, like, who do we really trust? And not that we're talking about anything we shouldn't be, quote unquote, shouldn't be talking about, you know, but when we do talk about some different things about our feelings about different things, who really can you trust? I mean, you know, for all we know, you're an informant or, you know, right. I mean, anybody you know could be like, you know, the woman with where somebody came in and planted and suggested to her that she, you know, bomb, what was it, someone's house or company or something. And they kind of coerced her into doing something she wasn't necessarily going to do in the first place.
Buying like, supplies
you,
and
right. Up, like, I mean, a piece of fear I got out of it was fear of not trusting people that I work with on a regular basis.
No. And I appreciate you being honest about that. And I think we all do, because that is a consequence of this. And I've certainly felt that when you, and not just about the stories of someone coming in and trying to prod people into, hey, let's go do this, let's go do that. Because that's not just what this is about. I mean, it's also, at least speaking personally, it's a fear of someone that maybe in your circle of friends or in your group or activist group who isn't trying to get you to do that, but they're just not really your friend. And I've had personal experiences like that, and it's really unsettling. And I think it's a struggle. And unfortunately, I don't have good answers for how we deal with that, other than trying to remind ourselves at the end of the day, you're in these groups and you're involved in these campaigns and you're an activist because you want to get the work done and you want to make a difference without sounding trite and, you know, and saying that. And you can't let this stop you. I mean, these tactics aren't new. And I know that can also be a pessimistic way of viewing this too, that these tactics have been going on for a really long time with a lot of other social justice movements. At the end of the day, though, we have to remember that that's not going to be changing, and we can't change our actions around it either. I don't think we should learn about stories like this and then be distrustful of every new person that comes in the group, because at some point we were that new person. So it's a definite balancing act, and I wish I could have concrete help for people, but I think the best way to deal with it is exactly how you did, by just being honest about it and saying this, you know, learning about this has made me really uncomfortable.
Well, and, you know, even people with the best intentions, you never know when someone's being scared by FBI or by police, who's going to roll over on you.
Yeah.
You just don't know who would do that. You know what I mean? You don't know how people, even good friends, how they would handle that situation.
It's kind of weird too. I mean, it's weird that essentially this, all that fear factor can be used, in like interpersonal manipulative things as well, even if there isn't anybody. I know, when I first started, you know, I wanted to get involved with an animal rights group and I didn't know anybody. I went vegan at 15. I didn't know any other vegans until I was 18. You know, I was the only one. And this is back in 95, 96. And when I finally found a group, I was so excited. You know, I just wanted to jump in feet first, obviously, because this is the most important thing to me. But, you know, a year later or maybe 2 years later, it came out that that group was really suspicious of me because I came out of nowhere and I was really enthusiastic. I mean, it makes sense, but it's like, wow, people, you know, people were suspicious of me. They thought that I could be an informant or, you know, I mean, and it's kind of weird. It's like, but it's me, you know, like I
you
know,
totally
me.
Are,
I know my
you?
Own intentions, of course, but it's just, it's like, wow. I mean, people are really paranoid. And that's also intentional. I believe that that's an intentional piece.
Absolutely. And it ties into, I mean, lawyers call it a chilling effect. It's, mm-hmm. it's not outlawing speech, but it's chilling it. And it's chilling it within our communities. And that is the intention, without a doubt. And that's no conspiracy theory. That's, I mean, that's the stated intention to neutralize groups yeah. by instilling fear.
Well, I mean, it's, and I want to talk about the Shaq case just a little bit, because essentially it really does mean, I mean, I think twice about what it is that I say out loud and what it is that I write to people because of the Shaq case. And, you know, these people were essentially convicted of terrorism and sent to prison for a very long time, some of them, because they spoke out saying, I support this, or, you know, I like it that somebody sunk a yacht.
Can you briefly explain the Shaq case?
Yeah, actually, I'd like Will to do that.
Okay. Sure. Well, the Shaq 7 are a group of animal rights activists who were involved in a campaign, an international campaign called Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty, that was targeting a notorious animal testing lab called Huntington Life Sciences. And Huntington had been exposed multiple times with really egregious animal welfare abuses, things like punching beagle puppies in the face and dissecting live animals over a period of years. And so as part of this international campaign, the U.S. activists ran a really controversial website in which they vocally supported a wide range of tactics. So if you went out and protested, that went up on the website. If you sent them something about leafleting or letter writing or making phone calls or sending emails, that went up on the website. And if people released animals from laboratories or vandalized an ATM or threw paint on somebody's driveway, that went up on the website. And the organization had a policy of publishing all of it, because their philosophy was, and this is part of the international campaign, that it all brings Huntington closer to collapse. And it did, without a doubt. This company was brought near bankruptcy. A multinational corporation was brought near bankruptcy by activists multiple times. So the government, being unable to go after the people and catch the people who are actually doing some of the crimes, like breaking windows or setting off smoke bombs, they went after the public above ground vocal faces, which were the Shaq 7. They charged them with conspiracy to commit animal enterprise terrorism, conspiracy to stalk, interstate stalking, and conspiracy to harass using a telecommunications device, which was coming from electronic civil disobedience campaigns. So far overreaching in order to try to set an example, exactly what this, a lot of this conversation has been about, set an example and instill fear and shut this campaign down.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Okay. So I want to just share my very favorite sentence in this book. And I haven't told you about this yet, but when I read this, I read it over like 3 times because I wanted to memorize it. And I just felt like you hit the nail on the head with my entire life. And the sentence is, activists should address the inconvenient truth without overly inconveniencing anybody. And I feel like I try walking that line in every conversation that I have, and, you know, every single action that I do, you know, I'm constantly weighing in this situation, like, how far can I go without turning this person off because it's too much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's different with each person, which is part of why, you know, I am so tired, even though tabling is amazing and wonderful and I love doing outreach, but it's like one after another, just these conversations and opportunities and using every tool I have to judge, you know, try to determine where somebody is and how I need to speak to them and what would make a difference in their life. And, you know, how I can bring that up and all of this. So yeah, I thought that that was really good. And I can imagine that our listeners too, even just being vegan, you know, constantly trying to educate people, hopefully,
even if they're not activists,
even, yeah, if you're not, if you don't consider yourself an activist, but
still
just
educating coworkers. And
yeah.
People
whenever you're
life.
Talking to your grandma about something, or your, you know, your coworker is asking you a question and you need to essentially determine how much to share without them, you know, without losing them and them saying, oh, I don't want to hear about it, or them getting angry with mm-hmm. you, or, you know, I mean, making things weird for months on end or whatever it is, mm-hmm. because vegans are a minority and often, I mean, just kind of treated differently. And I have a, I don't know, I would love to hear from our readers about that. I think it would be a
listeners.
Good, yeah. Or I'm sorry.
Our Will's listeners. Readers are listeners.
Yes, we have listeners. But I'd like to hear from our listeners about that in terms, I mean, we could have a whole episode talking about, you know, that line. And
I feel the exact same way. I'm really glad that you brought that up. And I know that I've mentioned before that, you know, for me, when I'm tabling and doing, and I love doing this kind of stuff, and, but it is, you know, whenever you're about to get into a conversation, even if you're tabling, which can be really, really stressful because every interaction, you have no idea what they're going to say to you. So it's, you know, or anytime it comes up at work or with a friend or with a stranger, you always have to turn on your activist switch and be ready to fight, not fight, but be ready to defend. And, you know, and you've got to
be,
you know,
smart,
pull from your bag of tricks mm-hmm. of all the different facts and figures and feelings and all these different things that you have to kind of mentally prepare for. And it's almost like a fight or flight kind of, you know, I'm sure there's stress hormones involved, but you know, when you deal with this so frequently, and even if you're not an animal rights activist, just being vegan, kind of constantly having to talk about this, you always have to figure out where is that line that you, because you do have to be really careful to not push people over the line so that they shut down and stop talking about it. And you never know where that line is going to be with people. And so the whole time you're having a conversation, it's, when am I going to get shut down? When are they going to stop me?
Or, you know, just assessing how things mm-hmm. are going. And, you know, and in a more macro way of looking at things too, with campaigns and, you know, literature and, I mean, everything that we do that we're putting out there essentially to try to educate people. I mean, activists take action, and we are, you know, ultimately trying to get others to take action as well. And so, I thought that was a really beautiful way of putting that really complex kind of everyday thing.
Every conversation.
Just this thing that we constantly deal with into one sentence. And I was like, that's brilliant. So thank you for that. That's awesome.
So I wanted to let people know, okay, so what is your website where people can find you and more about what you're doing?
The website I run is greenisthenewred.com, and it has information about the book of the same name, Green is the New Red. And I also write regularly about these issues and keep people informed what's going on.
And I actually, before I ever met you or knew about the book or read the book, bought one of your shirts because I thought it was such an awesome statement. It has the Liberty Bell and it says, "Activism is not terrorism." And I actually wore it today and had a debate with my husband over whether or not I would be dorky for wearing the shirt. But it's a great shirt, and quite a few of our friends have it because it's so awesome. And Dallas has the sticker as well. And you can purchase that on the website. It's such an awesome, beautifully said statement.
It's kind of funny, actually. Thanks for the sticker, Ryan, because you gave
Are
it to me.
Are you making fun of me? Are
no.
you about to make fun of me?
No. All right. No, you're my friend.
Okay.
No, but it's kind of funny because I have that sticker on my one of my many water bottles. I have many water bottles. But anyway, I have it on one of them, and it's the one that it's my biggest one, so I bring it to the gym where I go to take martial arts classes. So I take like Kali and Muay Thai and various classes. And there are a lot of police officers that train there, a lot of security guards that train there.
And so face the sticker right at them?
They give a discount, you know, to people like that. So the political spectrum is kind of wide, vast, I guess. But people don't really talk politics there too much. But I'm very aware that, like, whoa, I feel like it's a foreign kind of environment to me, to be around all these people that I wouldn't normally socially interact with. But yes, I do have that sticker.
So, and what else do you sell on the website?
So we've got some silly things. Like,
did we say what does, did yeah, you say what it says? Website. No, what
it
your says, shirt
says. Activism is not terrorism.
Okay. I didn't hear that. Sorry.
Yeah. So, you know, trying to get at something that everybody can get behind. If, I mean, if you can't right. agree with that statement, I, you know,
it's no matter what kind of activism you do, if it's for cancer, if it's for pro-life or pro-choice, or I mean, activism is not terrorism.
So other things, one cool thing on the website right now is an artist, a vegan straight edge artist in Portland, this guy, Matt Gawk, did some amazing posters for the book release. And I went on tour, and of course, all this stuff is out of pocket, all the traveling and stuff. So he volunteered to create these amazing screen prints that he signed and numbered all of them. So we've got some of those and t-shirts and domestic terrorist aprons that are reflect my really weird sense of humor and just the things that, I mean, I don't, and I'm not making, I've done nothing but take on debt from this project. It's just to try to keep the website running and to have fun. And
can people support you? Do you have like a PayPal link where people can donate to you on the website?
Absolutely.
Great. And I think kind of my last question for you is, do you have plans for another book? Do you have anything else that you're wanting to cover? And
absolutely, but I'm definitely haven't committed to what that is right now. I mean, frankly, I knew going into the book how intense it would be, but I didn't prepare for it. I mean, and having, you know, I work a day job too, that's 50 hours a week. So it's just, the whole process has left me kind of wrecked.
Yeah.
So, and I'm still doing publicity and stuff. So I'm trying to figure out what that's going to be, but I would really much, very much like to do another book.
Great.
Okay. You said that one of your aprons says domestic terrorist on it. Okay. I think Issa Shandor Moskowitz has one of those.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to make you aware of that. That's really funny.
Yeah. Okay. I like it. So now that you know that Will is doing this out of pocket, please donate from PayPal. $5, $10, $1 billion, whatever you
can. Buy a shirt or something, guys.
Yes, please do that.
All right. So, green challenge.
Green challenge.
Okay. It's time for the green challenge.
Green challenge.
Green challenge.
There's no gloves. There's no swords.
No white suits.
Uh-uh. It's just green challenge.
You're just doing the earth a solid. Well, abrupt transition.
A very awkward transition that we just had here.
Yeah, this really has nothing to... Oh, actually, I can tie this in. I'm brilliant.
Do it.
Okay, so I'm going to talk to you about cat litter. Yep. Cat litter.
Nothing makes me think of cat litter like Will Potter.
Well, from now on, I will.
Those two things are synonymous.
Let me tell you, not a quote for the next book jacket.
Yeah, I know. Yep.
A review from Midwest Vegan Radio.
No kidding. So weird. Okay, so cat litter. I've got two cats. They're cool. And they need a place...
To defecate?
They need a place to go.
You can say that.
So, I don't know. You know, it's different with cats. You know, I have words for that with dogs, but it's like, no, they're not even really that. They're just, I don't know. It's not something I think about a lot with them. But cat litter, conventional kind of the kind of cat litter that I grew up with anyway is like the clay litter stuff. I don't know who buys that, you know, basic stuff anymore. There's a lot of like people use clumping clay litter a lot of the time. And then there's also these like odor reducing things that have like weird crystals in them. And I'm sure they're full of chemicals or something. I don't know that may have, I don't know, bad things in them. So, in looking into cat litter, I started out with, there's this Yesterday's News, which is recycled newspaper cat litter. The only thing I really hated about it is that it's made by Purina. Ugh. I'm like, Purina, really? I so do not want to give my money to them. So I was really excited to find a cat litter that's made out of wheat. It's called Sweet Scoop. And I don't know where all it's available. I think it's available all over the place, like in big chains and everything, but it's from the hulls of wheat. So it's not the edible part. It's actually the part that essentially is like, I don't know, byproduct of wheat production. And there's natural odor neutralizing, I don't know, properties to it so that it reduces ammonia, which I believe is true having used it. It's also it clumps too. And it's the only, it's biodegradable obviously because it's wheat, and renewable because it's wheat. It's also flushable. It won't like turn into a clay, like the clay litter, like I just said.
It won't turn into a gooey thing.
If you try to flush it, it will, you know, I don't know, break up. So I thought like, wow, this is all pretty cool. This is great. But how I'm tying this in is that I know that sometimes in the past, activists who have felt like the FBI is, you know, checking in on them by going through their trash have dumped used cat litter into their trash to make it very unpleasant for police to go through the garbage.
Instead of putting it in a bag.
Yes. I think I did a very good job of that. But yeah, cat litter stinks big time. If you don't use the sweet scoop, it's not as bad with that. Of course, you know, I don't know. I feel bad about the idea that there would be all this loose cat litter and the poor sanitation people who...
I'm sure that's not the worst thing they're dealing with.
Well, probably not. But still, I mean, this is like, rather than having it in a bag, they would just dump it all in there and, you know, make it really messy and particularly disgusting.
It's still in a bag, though.
What do you mean?
It's still in the garbage bag.
No. I mean... Oh, well,
it's
no.
It's not like the police are going to go this around the outside of your garbage bag.
No. The idea is that, okay, so you take garbage bags, you put them in the garbage bin.
Yeah.
And then... the activist would dump the cat litter straight from the box in there. So it would be all around. So then, but that wouldn't be in a container. I mean, that's in the bin. So then when it went into the truck, there would be loose like confetti cat litter everywhere. And that's kind of sad.
To add another voice to this very important conversation, I have also heard these cat litter tales, and I think it can be in the bag itself. So that when people are tearing open the bags to go through your stuff.
Oh, so exactly. Then they just find a surprise.
Putting that stinky, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever.
So surprise. Sanitation people wouldn't have to deal with it. Okay. Just the police going through your garbage.
Do unto others.
Right. So thank you for clarifying what I was not able to communicate to Dallas. That's exactly the point I was trying to make.
It all ties in.
Really paid off.
So there's your green challenge.
Yeah. So anyway, check out biodegradable wheat cat litter. I think it's a good plan.
Yeah. And so for our product review, I think that's painfully obvious. Buy the book, Green is the New Red.
Yeah, we've talked about that at length. So
yeah,
we like it.
There's our product.
It's
we've reviewed it. We read it. We liked it enough to have Will come talk about it.
And if you have a problem with how we did this product review, you can take it up with us.
So yeah, go buy the book. You can purchase it at Ethique Nouveau, or you can get it directly from Will's website.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. There's a lot of online stores that have it too. And I would...
But probably best to get it directly from you, because then there's not other people getting commissions off of it.
Yeah, from that perspective. But for folks in Minneapolis listening to this, they should definitely come by the shop and buy it from you all. Support the work you're doing, without a doubt.
Well, we all are doing important work.
We all are.
So we like that. And then the only other thing that I think is really cool to mention that's not related, I don't think I can tie this in. Oh, I can tie it in. Oh my gosh, I'm so smart.
Yes.
Okay. So the Minnesota State Fair new this year has an, I don't know how these contests are run, but it's like, you know, you bake a pie and you can have them judged and somebody gets a ribbon. I don't really know how this works, like canning and jelly and pan. So this year there is a special category for a vegan main dish at the Minnesota State Fair, which is a big deal because the Minnesota State Fair is
torturous to go to.
I don't have a lot of good things to say about them, but now I do. I have one good thing to say about the Minnesota State Fair, that they have this entry. And I don't know if they're the first state fair to do this or what, but it's a big deal in Minnesota, in the Midwest in general, where agriculture reigns supreme. So yeah, I think if you are anywhere in Minnesota and you want to, or you know somebody who is, please have people enter. We really need a lot of entries because we want them to continue and maybe expand it. Maybe we could have a vegan dessert category, etc.
But be prepared to cry if you go to the state fair.
Yes.
Which
and
I
how,
did.
Yeah, I'm, it, I can't, I can't.
But I did find vegan food options. I had to go there last year because I had a friend visiting from Portland who wanted to go there. But I yes. cried. But I did find vegan food. So it
yeah,
kind
I,
of made up.
I know.
For the,
it's possible. Yeah, it's kind of. But how I'm tying this in is that when you're making your main dish, you better be wearing a domestic terrorist apron.
Yes. And when you show up at yes. the state fair, then make sure you're wearing your activism is not terrorism shirt, or at least a sticker.
Yeah. There'll be stickers.
Either way, you will be the life of the fair.
Yes,
sure.
you yes. Oh, gosh. Oh, man. So that's it.
Yeah.
That's all I have. Today. You have anything? No.
I got nothing else.
Elliot?
Good.
Maureen?
No.
Will, this is your last chance.
Thank you all so much for having me on the show.
Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
All right, guys. We'll talk to you later.
Bye.